welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It's episode number 254. I am your host, James Gilmore, and joining me is none other than Peter Willington.
Yes, my name is lengthened like that.
Yes, it's with all the accents on the wrong places. Oh, did you hear the new, the new Katy Perry song?
The new what?
The new... You know who Katy Perry is. Look, I'm not pretending to be a fan or anything, but I am aware of her existence. You know who Britney Spears is, right?
I know Britney Spears. No, go on. I know Britney Spears.
Her new single, what's the word? Oh, it's been driving me mental all week. Unconditionally.
Is this Britney Spears you're talking about?
No, this is Katy Perry.
Okay.
Her new single is called Unconditionally, right?
Yeah.
And this does relate to Britney Spears later. But the way she sings the word unconditionally, which is the chorus, right? Is so irritating because she puts the stress on the most unnatural syllable in that word. She doesn't sing unconditionally. She sings unconditionally. So she sings unconditional, and it's so annoying. It's like,
You can't... Have you got in touch with this Katy Perry?
Have I sent her a very sternly worded email? No, I haven't. It's up there. It's close to being up there, at least. With Britney Spears' Womanizer.
Womanizer. Which one's Womanizer?
Womanizer is you're a womanizer, womanizer. Oh.
Right, yeah.
Which, yeah, that doesn't start to grate after 10 seconds.
We all remember that classic. These are pop songs.
Yes.
And I know all of the pop songs.
Do you?
So Katy Perry is
take that and the new kids on the block.
Yeah, new kids on the block. When I was a youngster, I've started this, so I'll finish it. when I was a youngster, I used to watch the New Kids on the Block cartoon.
I didn't know there was any such thing. There was a cartoon.
It was a cartoon, and it ran just after this. It ran just after this cartoon about this American athlete who was really good at baseball and also American football, but he was also a superhero. He's like a real life guy as well. I can't remember his name. I want to say his name's Bo Jackson, maybe.
I've got no idea.
I can't remember.
Triathlon man.
Triathlon man or something. I don't care. I used to watch that New Kids on the Block cartoon, and I always thought to myself, I could be in New Kids on the Block. I could easily be in that.
I'm a kid. I'm relatively new.
I'm on the block.
Yeah.
I lived in a flat at the time, so I thought, easy, straight in.
The British version would be quite different, though, wouldn't it be? New Chavs in the flat. That's not the same, is it? Arguably appealing to a different demographic as well.
Oh, we should start that band.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, let's do it. I've got some little chairs that we can stand up off of. Oh. When the harmonies kick in our love song. I can easily, if you want, I can pretty easily get addicted to some like painkillers, and like you can develop a drug problem.
You could drink some Sizzup. That's what the kids are drinking now, isn't it?
Sizzup.
It's a mixture of codeine based cough syrup and 7-Up. I'm deadly serious.
That is
a thing that the rapists drink.
Sizzup.
The rapists and the Justin Biebers, they drink that.
I am Sizzup.
Incidentally, nobody do that.
No.
Podcast listeners, I'm assuming that we're all adults here, that you're all responsible enough not to go out and mix those two things together and drink it recreationally. So if you go and do it, I don't want anything coming back to me.
It's not about us.
No, I want stern calls from people from emergency services.
About Sizzup and, you shouldn't have.
Yeah, well, I only wanted to find out what the new Angry Birds was, and then he told me to drink all this codeine, and, you know, it all went downhill from there.
Sizzup. Yeah, real drug problem.
He does actually mean that, incidentally. So, you know, it all comes back to Peter Willing. Anyway, so games and that. Supercell are getting in the Christmas spirit nice and early this year by releasing a Clash of Clans update, what makes everything a wee bit festive. So it's a free update that goes to both iOS users and Android users. What you get is a brand new limited time special defense called Santa Strike, which showers down explosive presents upon enemy units. And also you get mystery contents. So the presents will open, you can go and find stuff, and it might be power-ups and all that sort of thing. The other updates include a reworked Inferno Tower, and you also get a few festive tweaks to the looting system and the interface, which has all been represented very nicely by that screamy giant bloke with the big blonde moustache that you see in the icon. He's now got a Santa hat on because Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So hooray for that. Also getting involved with the update are Rovio, who have just chucked a whole bunch of new levels onto Angry Birds Star Wars 2. This time you can now visit Naboo.
Oh, Naboo. Yeah, Naboo's the setting of the really good one, isn't it? The really good Star Wars film.
Yes, the Phantom. Yeah, that one. You can now go there and do fights in that with birds and pigs. Oh, it's trailed off, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so what you actually get is 40 new levels, 20 levels for the dark side and 20 levels for the light side. You also get a bunch of new characters you can now play for free, because all the characters are actually available in Angry Birds 2, provided you either pay for them in-app or you have the little toy that you scan in or whatever. But for the time being, you can get Padme, Captain Panaka, and Zam Wessel. Don't know who Zam Wessel is. Free. There are also four secret levels as well, which I think you have to hunt around for things on the map and collect items, and they unlock them, and there you go. And I think at least one of them has a boss in, so hooray, knock yourself out there. What's the last one? Dead Trigger 2, which is a slightly popular game, you might say. Mm-hmm. That's got an update. 50 new gameplays.
What?
That may sound like me being an annoying internet person and saying everything in plural, like we do. But no, actually, if you go to the product listing on the App Store and you look at the update log, it actually lists the game as adding, quote, 50 new gameplays.
Nice. Okay. I'm assuming, now, I don't mean to be stereotypical on this one, but I'm assuming that was written by somebody whose native language is not English.
I'm assuming, being as Madfinger as I think a Czech company, possibly something was lost in translation there. So
yes.
I'm going to guess they mean 50 new levels.
Or maybe they mean 50 new gameplays, like brand new ways of playing.
Quite possibly. Maybe you get...
What could you do with the Dead Trigger? Obviously, you got first-person shooting. That's one.
Well, yeah. You could have a Tetris zombies, where the zombies all fall from the sky, and you have to like fold them into different shapes and then stack them in a nice row, so that it could.
Yeah, physics-based puzzler where you fling zombies at humans and
angry zombies, possibly.
Angry zombies.
That'd be good. We got endless running zombies, I suppose, where they all just run constantly, and you have to run away. We have to come up with like 47 more of
these. I think the listeners get the joke. Let's move on.
So probably 50 new levels, we think. I haven't tried it yet, don't know. They've also gone in and rebalanced a few things. So the zombie difficulty has been tweaked. There aren't quite so many fast zombies. I think that was a complaint where people were being swarmed and mobbed by the fast zombies and they felt it was a bit unfair. They also, I noticed looking into this, they've listed the updates for the coming months as well. So I know that, like, for example, in January, you're going to get levels set in, I think it's China. Have a little look on the story and have a look in the App Store as well. But they've outlined the next 2 months of updates in advance. So there's a whole bunch more content coming. So that's quite exciting. It's quite cool. The other thing I'm going to mention, even though it's not technically an update, but it sort of is, Badland, which is that floaty endless runner where you control a little fluffy thing with wings. It looks incredibly pretty, silhouette styled thing. Won a lot of awards last year. We thought it was okay. Not as fond of it as everyone else. It's coming to Android. I think it's actually out on Android right now as you listen to this. It's an incredibly good looking game, and if you do like the floaty endless runner sort of things, it's definitely worth a look. We weren't quite as into it as everyone else was, but still, if you're an Android fan and you've been wanting it for a while, it's now yours. Go crazy. Now, a story came out about a month or two ago, which involved Square Enix talking about Final Fantasy VII. Basically, it had come up in a conversation they were having, and everyone's always looking to talk about Final Fantasy VII at any given opportunity on any given platform. And they were interested to see whether it was going to be coming to iOS, the person doing the interview. And Square Enix kind of cagely went, well, you know, we might want to do it, but not for a few years. In order to actually get it onto an iPhone at the moment, it would take way too many gigs. and it would just be implausible to do it as a download. The technology could probably handle it. The iPhone could run it, but it would be too big, and so it's going to take a while, and yada, yada, yada. This conversation came up because they were actually discussing the fact that they were intending to release Final Fantasy VI this year. And we weren't entirely sure when. It turns out that it's going to be coming apparently this December. So this winter, they said initially, and now it's actually coming out to be December. And I think yesterday, 2 days ago, they released the very first screenshots of the iOS version of Final Fantasy VI. If you've played the game before, it was listed as Final Fantasy III on the SNES. We've been over this a few times, but yeah, depending on whether you're in Japan or in the West, it was either 3 or 6, because the West only got half the sequels that Japan did. Numbers. Yeah. So you have played this before, probably, if you're in the West, as Final Fantasy III on the SNES. It's arguably one of the most beloved Final Fantasy games after Final Fantasy VII, I expect. Or indeed before, in some cases. Tells the story of Terra, the green-haired girl who's wandering around this kind of steampunk world, and I think has plot-essential amnesia, and has a huge cast of characters and lots of different traits and armor things, and it's actually a really good little story, and it's one of my favorite Final Fantasy games as well. So, it was with bated breath that we clicked on the link to see the first screenshots of the new version, and they put some side-by-side comparisons. I'll give credit to Siliconera at this point, because that's the site that we saw it on first. And there are two images placed side by side against their originals. These images have prompted mixed reactions. You can see them. There's a link in the podcast story. Go and have a look. Now, I'll throw this to you, Peter. Describe the differences between these two images.
So the difference is the new version is obviously a lot sharper.
Mm-hmm.
So with the Super Nintendo, you know, you're working with SCART cables and, well, not even SCART cables, often like aerial leads and all sorts of other gubbins.
Composite thingies.
So there's a kind of natural fuzziness, natural smoothness when you look at Super Nintendo sprites.
Mm.
So when you look at them on like a Retina display, you know, the pixels should come into sharp relief. But what they've done is instead of taking the original Final Fantasy VI/Final Fantasy III, pixels and made them sharper and just kind of ported it wholesale, they've slightly tweaked them so that they keep the general tone and the general design of the character designs, but they don't look right at all. for example, one of the screens that we've got over on a brilliant little website, tiny good little up and comers, appspy.com. You know, your story's got some comparison shots, and the first set is the ones with the little walking mech suits, and then Terra in a mech suit as well.
Yes, from the very beginning of the game, I think.
Yeah, from the very beginning when you're stood by the cliff, essentially, which everybody who's played it will know. And they look a lot less Nazi now. like they look a lot. There's a lot of that sort of stormtrooper look to the top ones, I would say, and like a very, and also a steampunk aesthetic. Definitely,
They look a bit more squat in the original version.
Yeah,
they're slightly
definitely
kind of hunkered down. But I don't know if that's a or an aspect ratio thing. It looks like it was slightly squished for some reason.
Mm.
But everyone looks a little bit taller.
Yeah, but you know, with these iOS ones, it kind of captures some of that theme, but it looks a lot more generic. It looks a lot more like something you'd knock up in RPG Maker rather than something made by arguably the biggest JRPG, well, definitely the biggest JRPG series globally.
Yeah.
And Terra, like, she looks washed out. Her colors look a lot more pastel-like, a lot more feminine rather than the bright, bold colors that come from the palette.
Yeah, the skin tones are very, if anything, like more Caucasian. I think she was always like white anyway, but in the original version, the skin tones are a lot more kind of orangey.
But it's small little things like that. And like, for example, the bun in her hair is gone.
Oh yeah. It might be like sealed or something, but
it's just little things like that. But when it comes to the architecture and stuff like that, like the backgrounds and so forth, they actually look really good, I think.
Yeah, the mountains in the background look strong, and there's also an image in the AppSpy story of one of the kind of compounds, one of the buildings, which is pretty much clad in just squares of metal. That looks pretty sharp. That looks very good.
I think that's great.
I'm sort of in two minds about this. I obviously like the original artwork, and we're sort of suckers for this, I suppose. Everyone likes a bit of pixel art, and if you remember the original, it's kind of strange to see it twisted and changed and converted in this way. Rather than just upscaling the pixel art, they've redrawn it. I wouldn't say this is as bad as, for example, the Ace Attorney trilogy.
Mm.
When they did the Ace Attorney trilogy, they redrew everything, and it's kind of rubbish. It doesn't look good at all. It had all this really dodgy shading in it, and it didn't have anything to do with the original, and it made you crave the DS version with its with its pixel-like low-res stuff. This doesn't look as bad as that. I just wonder if it's just me, just because I grew up with this and I know it, and I'm being all kind of reactionary and going, no, it doesn't look good. Well, where's my beautiful pixels?
This is one of the fundamental questions that we have to come back to when we're thinking about our heritage as people who play video games. Like, you know, we look back on these games, like, and Final Fantasy VI is a milestone in storytelling. Like, it is one of the most technically complicated games on the Super Nintendo. It's certainly a candidate for one of the first games that tried to tell an interesting story. It is, for want of a better word, a classic. And how we handle these classics for a new generation is really troublesome, because it's not like a Beatles record. You know, with the White Album, for example, you can take that vinyl recording, or you can go back to the masters and you can take that and you can put it onto an MP3, or you can put it onto a CD, you can put it on any number of things. And there isn't a ton of work that goes into that, because there's only one or two aspects that go through to it. And as long as you get that clarity, you know, you can always replicate the classic.
Mm.
Same with films, you know, you can make them look nicer. You
pretty them up, you can get rid of the noise and that sort of thing. But essentially, you're still left with what was originally printed on that piece of
absolutely.
Film.
Absolutely. But with games, we seem to, because they are so based on their technical merits, and because we haven't reached a plateau yet in terms of technology, which arguably we're probably just about to head into, because of that, when we go back and see these old games, there's always this temptation to go, oh, would have tweaked that, or oh, wanted it to look like this. And when you're in charge of a project like this and you think, oh, well, that's not quite right, you know, it doesn't matter whether or not it's quite right. That is the original experience, and for better or for worse, that's what that experience is.
Well, it's interesting, because it's Square Enix that obviously handles this. This isn't ported out to a third-party company who handles ports and said, there you go, just pretty up our game. Square Enix deal with this stuff internally, which is different from, say, for example, Dotemu, who are known for porting games. And we'll be talking about them later, because the Double Dragon trilogy appeared. Mm. But they all also worked on the Metal Slug games, didn't they?
Yes, I think so.
And they do pretty much straight conversion, so their games look an awful lot like the originals. They maintain the kind of pixel art look. Certainly with something like Double Dragon, it looks very, very similar to the originals. They've upped the sound, and you can switch a few options around to make it more modern, but at its core, it's very much the same thing. Whereas recently, Square Enix has taken the original games, for example, Final Fantasy IV, and then making them 3D.
Yeah, I think... the larger issue is, if you're going to go ahead and change the thing visually, why not go back and change some of the fundamental gameplay issues as well?
Well, like, actually
ooh, hello.
In Final Fantasy VI, this new version, apparently they're doing just that. According to the report, there was an interview done, I think it was with director Takashi Tokita, who's like the producer and director of the Final Fantasy bit. He's dealing with the project at the moment. And they're technically reimagining it, so it's not a direct translation. And according to him, it'll feature an overhauled battle system and a bit less grinding.
Mm. I mean, yeah, I guess that's a really good thing, because I think 6 really suffers from things like random encounters.
I know, it's a funny thing, the random encounter, because in some ways I'm like, there's a lovely concern, a constant kind of concern when you're playing the game, where you walk a few more steps, am I going to run into, and then the screen goes, and you're like, damn it! But also that's kind of nice, because you never know when something's going to come at you. You never know where you're next going to be challenged.
Especially because in Final Fantasy VI, a lot of it is about exploring the world around you, and considering the theme is exploration, it doesn't really encourage you to do much exploration. Like, it wants you to kind of go out and see the world, but it wants you to see it in the specific order that it's got in mind for you, and it's not going to tell you what that order is either.
If you do go wandering, then you know that you're going to take 5 steps and then wander into another fight, which could prove costly, and if nothing else, it just takes time. That's the thing. You want to get to a place and you wind up having to stop five times along the way to do random encounters. And it's basically time consuming. And I assume because they're aiming this for mobile play that they appreciate that people maybe aren't going to be able to pour 60, 80 hours into it. And if they can trim 20 hours off the experience, that might be to their benefit.
Well, I mean, like, even at just a fundamental level, like, the game uses save crystals. So I'm hoping that's gone for one thing, because if it's specific points to get to, like, points can be like 40 minutes apart, or at least they were when I went back and played it. So I don't know. I'm keen to see what they do next. And I know a lot of people are going to be really excited to play it and will probably just buy it anyway because it has the Final Fantasy name. But yeah, I hope they do the original justice.
Yes, me too. Well, it will be coming this December. We don't have an actual day yet, but in the next couple of weeks, it'll be out on iOS. It'll probably cost around £10 plus, or, you know, $15 plus, because that's just what they've all been costing recently. So you're going to have to pay a pretty penny for it, but we'll see if it turns out to be worth the cash. The other big release that's coming out this month that I want to talk about is The Room 2, which Pocket Gamer has managed to go hands-on with, and we have what I believe is an exclusive preview video. We talked to Fireproof Games in order to ensure that we weren't going to do anything too spoilerific, because it's difficult to preview this game because it's so much based around the puzzles and discovering solutions that if you show too much video, you're just giving the whole gaff away and revealing stuff you shouldn't. But what Mark has sensibly done is he's basically walked you through the tutorial, which introduces you to the mechanics, or reintroduces you to the mechanics anyway, and shows you how things are going to be a little different this time out. Not too different, but a little different. I forget if you played the original Room or not, Pete.
No, I still haven't played it yet.
Okay. That's right. So you were going to try and do it over Christmas, weren't you?
Yeah, that's the plan.
But yeah, put that on the list then. Okay. I did. I was a very big fan. I had to wait till it came out on Android, and then I did it again on iPad because I wanted to do it big. Now, the video itself is pretty heartening, I would say, if you're a fan of the original. The difference this time out, if you remember the original game, if you haven't played it before, it was basically trying to unlock a box. The whole core of the game was unlocking a box. There's a box on a table, and there are all these different buttons and little icons and switches and pulleys and levers that you're constantly touching and moving and stroking and twisting and just trying to interact with the box in any way you can to see what moves. And then work out how you open and activate different contraptions on the box. There was kind of no guide, really. You just kept prodding the thing until something happened, or a switch came on, or a thing flipped open. And it was a great, lovely, organic way of discovering what the hell is going on with this thing. The other aspect of it was that it was quite almost eerie, because you're in this sort of empty room and the box itself is uncovering sort of peculiar little mechanisms, and along the way you're finding fragments of text which you're explaining. It seems to be that someone's been in the room and someone's kind of gone mad in the process of it, and they've stepped into somewhere perhaps they shouldn't, and I won't spoil it but it's kind of a little bit creepy. This time around, one of the major differences seems to be that there are going to be at least two different boxes, or at least two different platforms you can work upon. So as you can see in the preview video, it draws in on this circular object that's sitting on a table that you can do twisting and turning everything. If you pinch zoom the camera, it flies back out, and there's another box, another container on a different table. So it looks, at least at the very beginning, like you're going to be flitting between two different objects, two different devices at the same time. I think they're trying to expand everything. So a couple more boxes this time, rather than just the one. Different environments as well, because you're basically in that dark, empty room the whole time in the first one. And I think there's going to be a little more variation in where you're playing this time around. You haven't played it, right? Have you watched any of this video? Have you had a chance to have a look at it?
Oh, I've played like the tutorial for the first game.
Oh,
like,
okay.
I've played the demo up to the end of that, and then they were like, we want some money now. I was like, Christmas. Christmas, you will have my money.
I see. All right, then. Even if you just played the original, you should be able to see that there are a few differences. It looks brilliant. I mean, the gorgeous first one looked great, but this one looks awesome. Same engine, I'm sure, but they've just prettied it up, and the design appears to be a little bit more involved, more detailed, if anything else, which is fantastic. They're acknowledging the existence of the first game, which is really nice. So in the first game, part of the way through, you came across this seeing eye thing, so like a little pair of glasses that when you put them on, you were able to see things that you couldn't see otherwise. It was like almost like an infrared or something, but instead of seeing things that were hot, you saw things that were maybe in another dimension or something. And right from the off, they reintroduced that mechanic in the tutorial. So they give you the pair of glasses, but this time they're broken and you have to fix them and get them working again. And as soon as you've done that, you're off. And that's just in the tutorial. So like what they did with Arkham City, where Batman starts off with most of the same gear he acquired in the first game, and then they just build more gear on top of it. So they don't rob you of all your stuff and then make you reacquire it again, which they can do in sequels, which can be a bit of a pain. It feels like you're artificially stripped of all your skills sometimes. There's a big interview with the guys at Fireproof Games, on PG Biz, I think. Keith or John did a great big interview with them, I forget which. Which is really interesting to read, and we've spoken about it on the podcast before, but they've been quite self-critical in a really positive sort of way. Sounds bad, but they've been very conscious of the fact that there were errors in the first game and things they wanted to improve on, and they've been desperate to put that right here.
We should start a petition now to give these guys the Myst license.
Yes, well, that would be an ideal thing for them to do. I mean, there's been a couple of people talking about Myst recently. Jonathan Blow's new game is quite misty, if that's a thing. I forget what it's called now, but it's the one where you're on an island and there's lots of prettiness, and again, it's all visual puzzles and that, and it is quite Myst.
That game would better be really good.
The problem is, I mean, I liked Braid. I mean, people have pointed out. I think it was on that you didn't at all. Not at all.
No.
Oh, I liked it.
No, but I thought it was boring. Don't get me wrong. It's a very clever game. I thought it was dull as dishwater. I quite like Jonathan Blow's rhetoric, usually. Mm-hmm. I think he's an interesting chap, and he's certainly a good force in the industry. The way that he carries himself, his next game has got to be as good, if not better than, and make as much impact as Braid, because otherwise it will have been built up and up and up. You know, and all of this kind of conversation that he has about how games move forward and making art and all of this sort of thing, and like moving people, and all of the articles in which he's been gone to for, you know, Opinion 101, like immediate indie opinion, like they will be for naught because he will then be a one-hit wonder. And it's like, you know, it's exactly the same thing that I'm sure the Team Meat people are fearful of, and one of the things that keeps Kojima from doing anything other than Metal Gear
not like, stop.
But yes, I really liked what I played of The Room, and I think those guys make games for tablets and phones very, very well. Like, yes. They know the tech, they know what it can do, and they know how people can interact with it. And I think they're really exciting in the field.
Exactly. It's one of those games where this couldn't exist as well on any other platform.
No.
This is iOS through and through, touchscreen gaming.
No. Absolutely. I'm sure the next game that you're about to talk to me about is exactly the same.
no doubt. About this week, speaking of games that are made specifically for touchscreen and iOS devices, we have Assassin's Creed Pirate. Yo-ho, yo-ho, and other pirate things as well. I'm not gonna...
Why is it? Why is it that we've been so immediately, and I class myself in this category as well. Why is it that generally the games press has been pretty down on Assassin's Creed Pirates since it was announced?
Like, well, I think half of the issue is it's not an Assassin's Creed game in the truest sense. So you're not taking control of a character and jumping over buildings. This is based entirely around a bunch of mini games involving dodging ships,
ship combat,
and firing ships and that. Yeah,
but there's loads of ship combat in Assassin's Creed 4. Loads of it.
I haven't actually played it, but I have seen lots of videos of people doing that. Yes, that is true. I don't know. I guess there's the automatic assumption that it's going to be crap because it's a mobile game. I think because of the console fan base, there's always that crossover when basically someone puts up a trailer of a game and it's from a beloved series. I'm going to cite Deus Ex The Fall here.
Mm-hmm.
When Square Enix put that trailer up, Deus Ex
nuts.
The Fall, and they were like, whoa, my new Deus Ex game, amazing! And they clicked it, and it was like, iOS what? And everyone just downvoted the video like a bitch because it was an iOS game and they wanted a full game. They're like, what? This is mobile crap, lol. Which was kind of a shame. I think that might be happening here to some degree. And I mean, I played it and I wasn't exactly bowled over at the beginning. However, it's come out, Pocket Gamer has reviewed it, and it's gotten a bronze award. Harry has said that despite the fact that it is a bit silly, basically, in a lot of ways. But he says silly in the right kind of ways. It doesn't have any common sense attached to it. It's not trying to genuinely recreate ship traveling. It's just a bunch of mini games where you're dodging stuff and shooting things. But at the same time, manages to be kind of fun regardless, which is a neat trick. I mean, I only played about 15, 20 minutes of it, and I was like, But you're pirating, you're shipping around the Caribbean. I'm using shipping as a case. There is an occasional bit of wibbly-wobbly sci-fi nonsense where it goes to the future, apparently. I don't know. All that stuff to do with the Animus, which clearly should have been rooted out of the whole franchise ages ago because it's complete pap. That whole thing, it just feels bogged down. And every time it flits back to Desmond in the future, you're like, oh, no, again.
So you haven't played 4 at all, have you?
No, I haven't.
There's some really interesting stuff. There's some really cool bits that make that a lot more plausible and a lot less like alien magic. it's very good. So I'm actually quite tempted by Assassin's Creed Pirates. I've kind of secretly had it on my radar for a while. Radar because of ships.
Yeah. Ships don't have radars. These ships.
They don't. They're made of wood, aren't they?
They have compasses.
Technically, if you think about it, if you think about it,
right,
really hard, you have to think about
with my head.
Yeah. Think about it really hard with your head. If you think about it, now that radar is such an easy thing, I've got a radar. Everyone's got radar, right?
Okay.
But now that radar is such an easy thing, wouldn't it make sense now for new pirates, good fun pirates, not the horrible ones, the actual pirates killing people, but like fun pirates, wouldn't it be better for them to actually make their ships out of wood? Because it wouldn't have a signal anymore, would it? You would never see them coming. Because it'd be like, oh, what's that out on the horizon? Oh, it looks like a ship. Can't be a ship. It's not got a radar signal. Oh, well, ignore it.
It doesn't just bounce off metal, though, does it?
I think it's just metal.
Are you sure? Because when I saw the documentary Captain Phillips, made with Tom Hanks, you know the documentary Captain Phillips.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know which Miley is Cyrus or whoever it is that you were mentioning is.
Entirely true facts, because I saw it in a cinema on a big screen. Therefore, it's entirely true facts.
It's a real thing.
Yeah. Then the pirates appeared on a radar and they were just in a little dinghy. And dinghies aren't made of metal.
Were they robots?
That plot twist was not revealed. I think they're keeping that for the sequel.
Right.
Captain Phillips. Terminator Revolution. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not a mariner, am I?
No,
so
you're not.
I don't know about compasses and that. What I do know is that when you play through this Assassin's Creed game, it obviously doesn't feel a great deal like Assassin's Creed as you would know and love it. For example, ship-to-ship combat is done by you going flank-to-flank with the ships, kind of drawing up alongside them. And then they're sort of moving backwards and forwards, almost in a shooting gallery sort of way. And you put your finger on the screen and a big arrow appears, and then you drag your finger left and right until you've got the arrow in the right place, and then you release, and your cannons fire, and hopefully, if you've judged it right, you smash into the ships. Then, when the ships start shooting at you, the camera kind of zooms out, and you do this little dodge game, which just looks funny because you've got this great big galleon ship, presumably powered by wind and not turbines and nitrous boosts, where they shoot a cannon at you and you time it right and then you press left or right and your ship like dodges out of the way.
Wow.
In a distinctly unrealistic, physics-defying fashion.
Is it slow-mo?
There is a bit of slow-mo, yes, actually.
Yes.
Mentioned it. Bit of bullet time.
Nice.
Cannon time, I suppose. Zooms out, zooms back in again. So, you know, realism's completely out the window, and it's kind of silly little arcade stuff. But you get to get new ships and upgrade your ship and pirate around the oceans, and Harry says it's quite good fun. I haven't played it enough yet. I will be doing a review myself for AppSpy, but it's gotten a bronze award. It said it's silly, but it's kind of good fun. So not the terrible disaster that perhaps we thought it might be. You can get it right now. I'm going to say it's £2.99 or $4.99, only because those are the numbers that happen to be in my head. And
you are right.
The iTunes page loading very slowly. I am right. Hooray. Check it out. Okay, cool. Yeah. So £2.99 or $4.99, you can get it right now. Surprise release, which actually came out last night, which sort of came from kind of nowhere. Telltale, guys behind The Walking Dead, the game, much acclaimed series that's better than the TV series, they released The Wolf Among Us for iOS last night. The Wolf Among Us being their follow-up, the first kind of new series they've done since the arrival of The Walking Dead. It's based on a series of graphic novels, just like The Walking Dead is. It's based on the Fables series that has been running, which takes inspiration from folklore and mythology, so like werewolves and vampires and anything you might think of from perhaps a grim fairy tale, and then anthropomorphizes these creatures. So your main character, for example, is called Bigsby Wolf, who may or may not get a bit furry at certain times of the night. Or when
doesn't he run a detective agency or something?
He does. He's a detective. I think he's a detective anyway. I downloaded it with the mind to review it, but I haven't played it yet. He is, yes, a detective person. He at least has to go in and start solving murders. And along the way, you'll be interacting with all these other characters who are based upon kind of classic fairy tales. And it's a bit dark and it's a bit violent. And, you know, the game itself is full of the same kind of choices and decision-making options that The Walking Dead was full of and made it so interesting and so good. So not quite as binary as something like the Mass Effect series, which I'm hugely fond of, but it did kind of devolve into here's a good option, here's a bad option, and here's a kind of neutral option. That's all you've got, and it becomes very, very binary after that. So you're like, well, if I'm a good guy, I just do the good thing. Whereas with The Walking Dead, the fun thing was that there was sometimes no good answer. There was no right way to get out of this decision. Whatever you did, someone was going to die, someone was going to suffer, and it was your choice to decide who that was going to be, which kind of broke your heart at times. So The Wolf Among Us, same principle. You've difficult decisions, maybe not a clear way out. The reviews are very positive for the Steam version and the console versions, and we weren't sure when it was coming to iOS, and it just suddenly turned up last night. They went, it's coming out, hey, go for it. It's £2.99, $4.99 for the first episode, or you can buy yourself a season pass, which sets you up to get access to all 5 episodes when they become available. Well, that will set you back £10.49, I think, or $14.99. If you can't wait, grab it right now. If not, hang on for the review. Something which has already appeared on Steam also, but wasn't met with quite such a positive reaction, though, is Space Hulk. Now, I know that you, Peter, will be old enough to remember Space Hulk.
Yeah.
That was not in a disparaging way, if you realize. If you are of a certain age, in your 20s or perhaps early 30s, then you'll remember Space Hulk as the Warhammer 40K game made by Games Workshop, tabletop game in which you built little cardboard corridors and you got your Space Marine Terminators, a squad of about 5 or 6 of them, and you would tromp through these corridors and you would roll dice, you know, dice. Before there were screens, there were dice, and we had tables, and you'd roll them, and numbers would happen. It was great. And depending on what the dice showed, it would depend how many gene stealers came tromping down the corridor and tried to tear your metallic limbs off. Gene Stealers, which were clearly ripped out of the Alien franchise, incidentally. Actually, what was the other one? Because the Tyranids, which is where the Gene Stealers come from. I'm going to go 40k geek now on you, just for a second.
Sure, go on.
So the Tyranids was the race, the army from which the Gene Stealers came, which were these 4-armed creatures that came down, and you know, looked kind of alien. But there was another one that basically had the H.R. Giger alien head. They were very, very fast, spiky, what were they called? Hormigants! God.
Hormigants.
Yeah.
And did you know that in 40K mythology, initially the Empire of Man believed that Gene Stealers were a completely different race to the Tyranids, that they weren't part of them whatsoever, simply because Gene Stealers act as a shock trooper unit that essentially is told by the hive mind through the latent psychic power that runs throughout the warp. The Gene Stealers act as these troopers that go into an area to see whether or not anything's worth consuming. So when the Imperium of Man initially found them, because there were no other Tyranids around at the same time, but they'd seen Tyranids out in the furthest reaches, they thought the Gene Stealers were completely different because they were never part of the Tyranid armies.
They were always seen separately, but then they returned.
And then they returned, I was reading up all about them today because they are, I think the 40K universe is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I genuinely like it. It was one of those things where I would play a little bit of the game itself, but I was more interested in the creatures and the painting, frankly. I liked to do the models, and I had a little Tyranid army going on that I very rarely played with. But I liked the universe. The different factions of Space Marines were interesting. The Chaos lot were fun. Nurgle's always entertaining.
The thing that really made me go, wow, that's a really cool idea, was the Tyranid sort of hive fleets. They sort of move as like a ball of a race almost. Like they move in huge swarms, tuna fish might move. And the idea is that they've all got this sort of very, very low-end psychic ability.
Yes.
And when they do, before they get to a planet, like several years before a planet, often the planet will fall into disrepair because the people on that planet become so depressed because of this strange psychic ability that they have. They become so depressed that they actually start infighting with themselves. So they pretty much destroy themselves before they get there. And
what, depressed hive tyrants and that?
No, depressed. The people of the colonies. They end up getting depressed. And
I like the idea of a kind of mopey hive tyrant and this Carnifex all like, rubbish.
I can't believe it.
Can't be bothered to get out of bed today.
I try and like wipe my mouth, but it rips it off because I've got blades on my hands.
Don't know why I bother.
That universe is really fascinating.
And we're getting caught up in this. We haven't even talked about the game. So Space Hulk, right? It came out on the PC a few months ago. Several times, but this time it's come out. I think there was a first-person Space Hulk game at one point.
Played that.
That was rubbish. They've done an actual conversion of the board game. The idea is it's a cross-platform, multiplayer board game conversion that lets you pretty much just play the original game on PC or iOS in this case. It got somewhat mixed reviews, was the problem. Very, very faithful to the original source material. That was one of the benefits. They said, yep, they've done a proper direct conversion of it. But some people had issues. And I think they're kind of the restrictions of the original game, frankly, where the game was based in very tight, small corridors, which you would wander down a corridor, gene stealers would appear, you'd fight them, then you go a bit further down, more gene stealers would appear, you'd fight them. That is the game. That was the original game, and that's what it is. And I think people have, you know, booted it up and gone, oh, I remember this is fantastic. And they've got a few missions in and gone, oh, yeah, it's just going to be this, isn't it? Which is, you know, not necessarily a failing of the people who've made the game, but perhaps, you know, an issue with the game itself, the original game. But people liked it. People found it was interesting. And it was very kind of claustrophobic because you never knew how many were going to come at you or what was down the next corridor. It was kind of randomized. There was always that element of chance where you could get taken down at the very next corridor. So it's out on iOS right now. We're going to have a review up for you soon. Harry's nearly finished it. He said that, you know, it's very much a faithful conversion of the PC version, both good and bad. So, you know, take from that what you will. But it is out right now and it costs
£6.99.
Ooh, yeah.
$9.99.
Right, yes. So, yeah, maybe wait for the review to see what it's like, unless you're a hardcore fan of the game, in which case, dive straight in blind. Go on.
Go on.
You love it. Another thing you may or may not love, Double Dragon, which we had a discussion about a while back, in which you voiced concern about this very release, Peter Wellington, saying that perhaps they're porting the wrong versions of these games.
I think they definitely are.
Well, it's done now. It's out.
Yeah, yeah.
.emu have released
it. Didn't even listen.
No. Strangely enough, they didn't hear this podcast go, oh, no, lads, we screwed it up. Go back to the drawing board and make
one guy thinks that one particular version of the game is much better. Back to the drawing board.
So they've gone ahead and released it anyway. The Double Dragon Trilogy is now available. What it gives you is essentially straight iOS ports of the arcade versions. Is that right? Yes, which in your view is not the best versions. And they pretty much look almost exactly the same as they ever did, as we mentioned before. It's pretty much a straight port. A couple of differences. There are now new difficulty levels. So there's kind of a normal mode and a hard mode. And then there's a difficulty mode expressly designed for touchscreens. That's how it's described, right? Which I'm going to read as very, very easy mode.
Yeah.
Because of touchscreen control emulation stuff. Yeah. You also get a couple of options for the music. So you can listen to the original 8-bit soundtrack, or you can have a newly mixed version with all fancy synth effects and, I don't know, Van Halen guitars, something like that. You can hear the music in the trailer, which is up on the site, incidentally. And you can go multiplayer, thank goodness, because that is kind of what Double Dragon was all about. Mm-hmm. You and a mate going all kung fu on one another. And I forget, Double Dragon, you could hurt each other, couldn't you?
Yes, in fact,
I remember.
The game is about, well, at the end of the first game, that's the big twist.
Yeah, you have to do a fight against your man. In everyday combat, you can actually hurt each other, which I remember being fun. There's a big line between games that would allow you to assault the other player character or not. And that led to so many brilliant arguments and probably real world violence.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is when you do a spin kick and you knock your mate off of a platform and they die and lose a life and they've only got like two or three,
yeah,
it can really bruise a friendship. Because you need all of those lives.
It's true. It's tough. It's difficult. We haven't got the review up yet. You can get it right now from the App Store. It's £1.99 or $2.99. Or if you're an Android user, you can get it from the Google Play Store for £2.69 or $2.99. Now, take a look at those two conversion rates.
What?
And yeah, the Google Play Store basically just, I think they have a dartboard with some numbers in it and they just throw it and go, that's what it will cost in pounds. So you're being stiffed completely.
No one's buying these anyway.
Piracy, lol. Yeah. So if you get it from either platform, cheaper on App Store, whatever, you can get it now, but check out the review when it goes live. Finally, I want to talk about Bleck.
I love this name for this game.
I know, it's good, isn't it? Other than just being a strange noise you make when you're trying to get a hairball out your throat, Bleck is a touch-based puzzler, which is quite an interesting little concept, actually. We have reviewed it. We've given it a silver award. So you've got coloured dots on a screen, and in order to get rid of these dots, you need to draw a line that will pass through these dots, thereby eradicating them from the screen. However, instead of drawing them directly over the circles, like you would, for example, if you're drawing, noughts and crosses and you put a strike through all the objects at the end of the game, instead of doing that, you draw on the screen, for example, on the left-hand side, you draw a little straight line, and then you let go, and that straight line, that little shape you've drawn, will shoot across the screen in the direction you drew it. So if you decide to draw a little squiggly line, for example, like a little wave shape, the moment you take your finger off the screen, it'll kind of undulate across the screen, like wiggle along like a little wave in the direction you drew it. And the idea is you draw the line or the shape or the pattern, and then it will snake its way along the screen and hopefully go through the circles that you're trying to eliminate, which is a weird thing to explain, but if you look at the video on the site, you'll see how it works. It's actually a very elegant little thing. So initially it starts out where there are just a few dots on the screen. You can just draw a straight line pretty much at whatever angle. Later though, black dots appear and you have to avoid them. So in order to get rid of the colored shapes, you have to start navigating through the black dots. And that's where it starts becoming really, really tricky. Harry really liked it. There's 60 puzzles that you can go through. And again, it's one of those games that this can only really exist on a touchscreen.
Yeah.
And anytime someone does a game like that, I got to salute it, run it up my flagpole, because it just shows common sense and it shows an awareness of the device you're creating things for. And I really like that. So it's a proper iOS game. You can get it right now. It costs £1.99 or $2.99. We suggest at the very least taking a look at it, because it's a great looking thing. And if you think it might be up your alley, grab it. Come sit upon my throne of games. It's that time again, everybody. Come in to the chamber wherein lies the throne of games. I'm going to hop straight up this week. We're running out of time, so we're going to motor on through. I've been playing Skulls of the Shogun, which originally started life on Windows 8. I think it was released for the RT tablets, and I think you could probably play it on PCs as well. I'm not sure. I guess it's a turn-based strategy game, but there are elements of real-time, as in you're physically putting your finger on the screen and moving troops around for them to go in and attack. It is set in a sort of Eastern mythology, folklore thing, whereby you are a great general-type person who has been killed and gets sent to the underworld. And once he gets to the underworld, he finds himself in line waiting to enter the underworld. It's all very bureaucratic, a bit like Beetlejuice. And while he's waiting in line to get admitted, he basically starts a Barney. He kind of gets all like up himself and like, I don't want to be doing this. I shouldn't be doing this. I am the mighty general and we should be fighting. And there are these forces who are like, oh, you get back in line and cut it out. And he's like, no. And other people start listening and go, hey, I like the cut of this dead guy's jib. We should all totally revolt against the oppressive ways of the Eastern afterlife. And so they do. And this results in turn-based battles of armies facing off against one another. Small armies, we're talking groups of, you know, initially like three or four, but obviously it grows as time goes on. And the way that these battles play out are in a turn-based way. So you get your turn, you can move physically, put your finger on your dude, and then you drag him to where you want him to be. Obviously, they have limited movement range. You can run in, you attack. You've got different classes of troops, obviously, so there are men with swords and that, and you've got a couple of archers and people on horses and all that. What differentiates it from other games, I suppose. A is the visual style is very, very nice. It's kind of a cartoony thing. It's quite visually witty. The animations are really beautifully done. The dialogue's actually quite entertaining as well, in its own little way. Whenever you go in for attacks, you'll have your enemies kind of like shielding their face and freaking out. They know they're going to be killed. The camera will zoom in if it's a dead strike or something like that, and you slice through and they die. So there's a lot of kind of visual flair. And it looks very nice in that eastern, the sorts of cherry blossoms flittering around in that stereotypical way. But it's got this undead zombie slant. So technically it's kind of a zombie game, but without it being a zombie game, which is nice. I didn't even consider it till now, which is a good which is a good thing, because I would have immediately deducted points in my head because I'm so sick of zombie games. But it's a credit to it that it doesn't feel like that kind of game. It's initially easy to learn and easy to get into, but it's quite deep. It gets difficult quite quickly. The guy that you're protecting, your main commissar general fellow, he kind of hibernates at the beginning of every match, every round, if you like. And if you awaken him, he'll obviously kick into action and start fighting. If he dies, it's game over. So you have to protect him at all times. If you can keep him asleep, all the time that he's hibernating, he's regenerating health and gaining more health. So ideally, if you can do the entire fight without waking him up at all, then that's great and you get massive bonuses for that. However, the moment your troops start pushing forward, you leave him unprotected, and the enemy can come in and sweep round and flank him and start killing, and then it'll be game over. You also get little things like, for example, as a window into the kind of mechanics we're talking about. Archers, you can fire at enemies, but if you fire at them straight, then they are likely to retaliate. They'll automatically fire back or try and hack you down. So what you need to do is you position them behind ground troops, and if you do that, and then fire over their heads, then they will not get attacked. There will be no comeback from the attack until the next round.
This sounds very tactically complex.
It actually is, and that's what's interesting. You start playing it, and you think it's quite nice and simple. And there are a few strategy games that are kind of not dumbed down, but they're pared down a little bit for mobile games, because you've got a smaller screen and you maybe don't have quite the room to make all the mouse clicks and the F key shortcuts.
Streamlined.
Yeah, and that's not a bad thing.
No.
This gets quite complicated and does get quite deep. It's very good, to its credit, because I've been capturing the gameplay. I've been playing it through on an iPod Touch, and it does feel like it was designed for a tablet.
Right. Which,
so, I there are several occasions where I click on a dude, and then I click to move him, and it selects the troop that's standing 2 pixels to the right. So there's a bit of that going on, which is a little bit... And the zoom in and out on the camera isn't as much as I would like. But you can tell that the game itself is actually really, really good. It does seem to have suffered ever so slightly in transition to a smaller phone. And I now sort of want to play it on iPad. For capture purposes, I can't, because I want it to fill the screen but on the video. But I think it would probably work a little bit better on a tablet. If you do get the chance to play on a tablet, I would suggest you do so. It's very smart, both like visually it's smartly presented, but also it's quite mechanically complex and gets far deeper as you go through. Other troops start appearing, and you can summon these kind of medic dudes which you need to bring into battle. And there's this whole thing where you possess rice fields. In order to conjure up new resources, new troops, you need to possess rice fields, and then if you haunt them, so you put a troop on it and he haunts them, then you'll earn rice. And this rice then goes into paying for new troops, essentially, which appear out of this little building, which you have to haunt. And if the enemy takes over, you lose control of it and they start generating new troops. So there's an awful lot to consider and an awful lot to juggle. It leads you in pretty carefully. It's going to take quite a long time to play through. There are like 24 stages, and it takes a while to get through, just as like stage 6 or 7. It takes, hours. So there's a lot of content in there to play through. The other thing is that you can do 4-player games. I think it's cross-platform. I haven't tried it. Don't hold me to that. But it opens it up to multiplayer, which is fantastic as well. So it's got an awful lot going on. It's really good fun. It's beautifully presented. I think maybe if you can play it on iPad, it would be slightly better than it is on iPhone, just for those like tap-to-move concerns. But apart from that, it's a pretty solid recommendation. Skull of the Shogun, I think, again, £2.99 or $4.99. What about you? Have you been playing iOS things or something a little bit more console-y?
Oh, a little bit more console-y. I've been playing Skylanders Swap Force.
With the plastic dragons.
With the plastic dragons and the little portal of power and all of the toys. So this is on the 3DS, not the Vita. Okay. Very deliberately not the Vita.
Oh, really?
Which seems a bit like Activision snubbing that platform. But there we are.
Didn't the same thing happen with Disney Infinity?
Yeah.
Yeah, it came out for everything except the Vita.
Yeah.
Oh.
Now, Skylanders Giants could have done which is the previous one, could really have done with coming out on Vita, because it was very badly optimized for 3DS. And one of the issues that I kind of levied at it was that the screen refresh rate basically just couldn't keep up. So basically, animation was really stuttery and frames dropped to like 10, 15, 20 frames a second, like really, really slow stuff. Mm. And I'm one of those people that I'm sure listeners will understand. I don't mind a bit of slowdown, like in where it's appropriate. So, for example, those shooty cave games. Love it. Love it when it's there.
It's arcade authentic slowdown.
Yeah, arcade authentic slowdown. Come on. That stuff's great. But when it starts to affect how you play the game, which is things like it would become so stuttery and jerky that you would put an input in and it wouldn't move.
Oh.
Yeah, it was things like that. So this one does away with all of that and runs beautifully on the 3DS. The draw distance is phenomenally long, except for like a few bits and pieces of detail in the areas. Like sometimes that'll pop in a little bit late. But generally, it's a very handsome looking action platformer in the vein of...
Oh, right. I was going to ask. I've not really played it before. So it's like a third person perspective action platformer?
So, yeah, third person perspective action platformer. It's got a bit of jumping, a bit of moving platforms, a bit of punching lots of bad guys. You know, it's your Spyro, it's your Crash Bandicoot, it's your Croc, Legend of the Gobos.
you went there.
What it's also got is toy collecting. And one of the ways that you interact with the game is you have this thing called the Portal of Power, and you put real-world toys into the game. I mean, it's kind of cool. Like, when Skylanders kicked off, everyone was a little bit like... super excited about it, like, oh, I'm going to collect all these things. And I think it kind of died off with Giants and with Swap Force, certainly. But kids definitely, like, are all about these. You know, when you were a kid, you had, like, collections, right? Stickers and football cards and all sorts of stuff like that.
I was like Egon Spengler. I collected spores, molds, and fungus.
Yes, exactly.
Cheaper than Panini cards, I think.
It is cheaper than Panini cards. Actually, funnily enough, Panini... is a short walk away from my family home in Tunbridge Wells.
Funnily enough, Panini is a short walk away from me because there's a Costa Coffee down the road that does really nice ones.
I thought you said funnily enough.
Whoa, shots fired.
I need some caffeine. So yes, it's a kid's game, but it's the kind of kid's game that you wouldn't be ashamed of playing with your child. Like, it's not the sort of Ice Age mini game-a-thon, and it's certainly not Disney Infinity for 3DS, which was just a mini game.
Oh yeah, it was completely different from the console
completely different. But this is very faithful to the home console experience. It's certainly not the home console experience. It doesn't look nearly as good, but it kind of mimics that action platforming. But yeah, so you've got this pool of power, and you have these real world toys, and you put them into the game, and they turn up on your 3DS. You don't have to take the portal everywhere with you, which is an absolute godsend, because you can save them onto your game cartridge. So you can swap between any characters that you've previously put into the game, which is really good. And the big thing for this outing is the Swap Force. As far as I understand, they're not technically members of the Skylanders hero group or whatever it is, but the Swap Force are a team where you can take the top half of them and you can remove it and you can put it on another member of the Swap Force. So you can swap their powers, basically. Okay. And that kind of brings about a few new changes, like you have to have certain combinations of certain characters to go through certain areas, and it's all built into this let's buy more toys, let's bug your parents to buy a fire one, and let's bug your parents to get this other giant one or whatever. But it's great, you know, like, if you've got a big collection of Skylanders already, you know, it's really cool. Like, I've got a generation one I think he's called Drobot, and I keep him because he is really useful to kind of have from the first series, so that you can kind of test that it's all still there, and it all still works, and you level
up. He's your control Skylander.
He's also the best character. And you also level up your characters, so they get more powerful, their attacks become more extravagant and elaborate, and you get more access to more abilities. And you can then update, if you put the Portal of Power you connect the portal of power again and then put the same toy on again.
Stop saying portal of power. Portal I can't power. Take this seriously. Right. If you're going to call it the portal of power.
Portal of power. But you can update the information on the Skylanders toy as well. So you can take the toy and put it into the 3DS game and play with it there, and then take the toy out of the 3DS game, essentially, and put it onto the main game, and it will keep all of its level and all of its experience and all that sort of stuff. So it's basically a complement game almost. Like, it's a, well, we've got the home console version, we may as well get the other one as well, like, to keep Timmy when he's in the back of the car. You know, it's a very enjoyable game, and they've sorted out a lot of the technical issues that sort of plagued the last one. It's not a game to get super excited about, hence the tone. And certainly, if you're not a fan of Skylanders already, it's probably not going to change your mind on that. But if you haven't played the series before, or if you've got a kid who's just coming to the age where they're just getting a 3DS or a 2DS or whatever, and they're kind of interested in Skylanders, like, it's a really good option for them. And it really does put in stark relief the fact that there aren't that many games for kids. Like, I kind of was thinking about this throughout the entire review. Like, the amount of games that I play that I would think, if I had a child, I would not want them to be experiencing them. Like, I was kind of thinking, what would I want to give my kids? And this is one of them. And I can't think of many others that
it's quite platform specific as well. Because, like, when it comes to the what would you give children, it's like, well, I'd give them a Wii, you know, or a Wii U, because, well, less so a Wii U, obviously, because it's on no games. But the games that are there, like, you know, I understand Super Mario 3D World, which has just come out, is fantastic.
Fantastic,
utterly
yeah.
fantastic.
Yeah.
And that's what you want to give a kid, because it's a brilliant game, and it's totally child-friendly. But you're right, a lot of stuff is quite skewed towards at least a teenage or even mature audience. And it's difficult to find stuff that isn't just fluff. Often making a child's game seems to be some kind of synonym for, I'll just make some crap.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Some fluffy crap, and that's just not the same.
Just like a collection of naff mini games, or like a platformer with no ideas. Like, and this, you know, it's not the most challenging game in the world, and it's not even as good as a lot of the platformers that are on the 3DS.
Right.
But you know, it is a very, very good option. And you know, toys is toys. So you know, if you're already invested. True. You know, you may as well jump into it. And I do like the toys. They are very well made.
We've discussed your love of your little purple dragons and that.
They are good. But yeah, that's what I've been playing, and thoroughly enjoyable it was.
Oh, fantastic. Well, there, early Christmas advice there for parents looking to get stuff for their kids, or indeed for themselves, if they like collecting little purple dragons. With Christmas on the way, actually, we're going to do a few things for the podcast. We'll have a little retrospective. We'll have a look back. We'll see what the best games of the year were, and then you can tell us what you think.
Because our listeners are amazing, but they're a quiet bunch. But because it's a special occasion, we should get them to write in.
We could do a public vote, actually. We could actually get you to send us what you think, retrospectively, looking back on 2013. What do you think the best mobile games were? Now, this can be for iOS or for your Vita or 3DS or whatever. We're just interested in mobile games as a whole, because this is Pocket Gamer. And we don't leave anyone out here.
No.
We're dead inclusive. So you tell us, we'll give you like a couple of weeks, we'll lead up to it, and what we'll do is we'll do a rundown. We'll say what Pocket Gamer has listed, because we're going to be producing our own lists as well, but we'd be very interested to see what the public opinion was, because the two can very often differ. What is critically acclaimed is not necessarily commercially popular.
Now, if I was a listener, how would I get in touch with us?
Well, you'd probably want to write in at podcast@pocketgamer.co.uk.
Oh.
The address is actually at the bottom of the podcast story on the site. You can reach us there, and it'll come through to both me and Peter. We can take a look, and we can go, and silently judge your responses.
Oh, you thought that was good.
Yeah,
huh?
Did you? Oh, really? Oh, yeah, whatever. Yeah, we'll do that. And then we'll talk about it in a few podcast time. We'll give you the big pre-Christmas rundown. But until then, thank you ever so much for listening to us this week. We'll be back again next week with more mobile gaming news. Thank you, Peter, for joining me, and take it easy, one and all. Bye-bye.
Bye.